There is a podcast brewing that's about to take over podcasting for good. The only podcast that you are going to need to tune into day in, day out, is the Member Guest Podcast.
If I can hit it down the middle of the fairway, that's great. But again, with the driver right now, the driver sucks.
John Daly, and you're listening to the Member Guest Podcast. Rip it, rip it.
Welcome to the pod. Welcome to the studio, Luke.
Thanks, Jordan. Happy to be here. It's kind of exciting.
Get a little closer. Yeah, otherwise then the people get mad at us because our audio is bad and they can't hear all the great things you're saying.
I love it.
All right. Luke Benoit, somebody that I've taken lessons with and one of the top swing coaches in the state. And I think I saw you were ranked number one. Was it Golf Digest?
Yeah, Golf Digest.
Luke, last year, 2 years ago, I can't remember when I saw it, but congratulations.
Thanks, man.
And is it founder or co-founder of the Ripstick?
Yeah, founder. And I got a buddy, Scott McDonald, who's kind of my co-founder as well. But we've been doing that, 3.5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to save most of the questions I got on Instagram for later, but there was one. I don't know who it is, but he says, ask him when the last time he beat his business partner in golf was.
And it's probably Scott.
Is that Scott? I don't know what the username was, so I couldn't remember their name.
Well, the story is I played a lot of golf growing up, and Scott was a runner, and he wasn't very good at golf. We were on an MGA team, and I had to work really hard as a senior in high school to get him on that team because he averaged like 83, and he was just horrible. And so we graduated.
Bogey golf.
Yeah, it was, basically like shooting 80 at age 18. And then he just got a little better and better and better. And now he's a +4. I barely play. If I play a little bit, I'm probably a +1 or 0. I don't know.
Well, this got to a +4.
Yeah,
so
are
you giving
now.
Him lessons or how solid is a +4?
He's got a homemade grip. I remember one time we were playing a PGA four ball match because we've been partners for years and we've had some luck. We won it twice, but I can't, like one of our first times out there we're playing and he gets a golf lesson on his grip during this. We're playing against two other pros and he's a pro.
Yeah.
He gets a lesson on his grip. So it's super homemade, but he's really good at golf now.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, if you're a +4, you gotta be pretty damn good.
Gets it around. So,
So what, if you wouldn't mind just kind of like background about yourself and then, would love to talk a little bit, one about the Ripstick, but two, kind of your philosophy as a swing coach. You have gained a massive following on social media and people obviously like the stuff that you talk about. So it'd be great to kind of break down, where you came from, where you're at now, what you want to do next. And then, had a bunch of questions come in from listeners. So I want to go through some of those too.
Yeah. Well, I can begin grew up in Faribault, Minnesota, played at Faribault Country Club, used to kind of haul my clubs on the back, of my bike, basically on my shoulders, take them to the course and played a ton of golf starting at age 13, played a lot of sports growing up. But golf was super fun for me because I got to hit the ball a lot, where I played baseball previously, I'd get to hit 4 times a game. And I was like, that's boring.
Yeah. And you maybe get a hit like once out of every 4 times if you're good, right?
Yeah.
2 if you're really good, if you're HOF. Yeah,
exactly. So I just loved just the opportunity to have more participation is something I like to do, like hitting a lot of shots. And I was like hooked immediately, just playing a ton of golf, 200 rounds a year for the first 3 years.
Wow.
Became a 0 probably within 3 years, just playing a ton. Had no idea what I was doing, just got in the hole, So kind of drove me toward trying to learn this game. And I had pro at the time. Ken Gore gave me a golf book, Ben Hogan's 5 Lessons. And that's when I started like understanding the technique side of it. And the mechanics were pretty interesting to me. And it probably ruined me because I got this weak grip going. And I had no idea what my swing looked like. In a retrospect, it would have been awesome to have some lessons, but I was really steep, I was jumpy, and all this stuff was, not what I felt I was doing at all.
Yeah.
And then I started doing some video and digging a little bit deeper on it, and I realized, man, I got to start fixing stuff. But by that point, I was already a college player, I was a pretty good player, and I was ready to turn pro, and I took a lesson from a guy, Gary Greenquist at Minicata, and Gary was like, man, Luke, you got a lot of interesting things going on here.
Like with the swing?
With the swing, because I had pretty decent power, but I had no control. I was a terrible driver of the ball. I'd hit it everywhere. I had just no control. But you get me inside of 150 and I was pretty good. And inside of 100, I was probably tour good. I was really good with wedges and putting and chipping. And get it up and
that'd
down.
That'd be fun to be able to throw darts and get up and down from anywhere. That'd be sweet.
So if the course was open, I was like, I was going to be four or five under at least. And I had a bunch of rounds. I've had a lot of rounds at 10 birdies. I've made 12 birdies. I've had a lot of rounds like a really low 60s. But you give me a tight course, give me some trouble, I'm terrible.
Some tree lines here in Minnesota.
So I know what I am and what I'm not. And my swing is better than it used to be, but certainly like getting the tee ball in place never been easy for me. So
you went pro and then after that decided you started wanting to get into like how did the transition from being pro go into the like ripstick and coaching and all this stuff, or not even coaching, but like swing, you know?
Well, in trying to fix my own swing, I realized I love engineering and mechanics. Like, I'm just super interested in it. I took physics in high school. I was
got to be in numbers and lines. Like, you got to have that type of brain to understand the golf swing.
Yeah, right? It was fascinating for me. And there's so many different elements. And you think about, like, there's three major domains you have to know to be good at golf instruction. Number one, you have to know like some biomechanics and how things move. And you could pick that up anecdotally. So, like there's some good coaches that have no formal background of biomechanics, but can kind of see patterns and know what's going on, right? Then you have to know psychology because you got a person. It's not a robot in front of you. So you need to learn how to like deal with people.
Yeah, someone emotions. Like me who's a little mental when it comes to like the golf swing. Yeah.
And you're pretty normal, right? Relatively.
If you had met my co-host, Andy, you would probably say, yeah, I'm pretty normal and he might be mental.
It's all relative. It's a scale.
Exactly.
But yeah, you got to do that. And then the last part is like motor learning, which is how people actually learn. And so when I started coaching and I was 10 years of my career and I was like, man, how do I get really good at coaching golf? Because I'd read a bunch and I had tried to do everything. I spent my 20s. My goal was to become the best teacher I could possibly be. I was like traveling the world, like doing a lot of like teaching in different places, a lot of Minnesota, but around. And I realized I just got to be a master of motor learning because that's where this thing really like hits, you know. The rubber hits the road when you understand how to make people change a pattern fast and be efficient with that learning.
Yeah. And we've talked about that before too. And before we dive too deep into that, how do you define or set a goal for like being a good teacher, right? Like it's probably a lot relative to call it, you know, the golfers that come and see you, but just kind of in the industry, how do you get to that point of being like a top golf instructor, whether it's for full swing, chipping, putting, right? People get these, you know, awards and accolades, like, how do you measure that?
It's really tricky. And I would say like, number one, like I'm going to let the cat out of the bag here. A lot of it is like how you relate to other pros because pros vote for pros in these lists. But
so there's that's how the lists are made. Pros vote. Okay. Got it.
And I, bottom line, I just want to be, and I strive to be a good person and share my time. And I like helping other people, you know, and a lot of us in this profession are that way. So we have a great profession that way, but you know, you have to be good at getting along with other people and sharing what you know. It's not about, oh, I know this and I'm not going to share it. Like share what you know. You know, that's bottom line.
Yeah. And you're doing it. That's how I found you. I showed up at Interlochen one day and I was looking at I think I sent you a video of the first swing that I had where I was like, literally this over the top and what it looks like today. It's a little bit better, a little bit cleaned up.
Yeah.
And so you go from, and you still do teaching and instructing, but when did like the ripstick come into play? I think that's where like a lot of people know you from or have one in their bag. Like I had one in my bag before I even knew you were involved with it. Like was there this kind of aha moment of the game is going to speed and the game is going to how far kids can hit it. And now we're starting to see that come to fruition now. But like, was that the thought process or where did it come from?
Yeah. I mean, I was coaching all these elite juniors, and doing a lot of super speed with them in the winter to crank speeds. And they're all starting to pick up speed and starting to realize like, you know, just cause you're 15 doesn't mean you can't hit at 330. Like you can just hammer it when you're a kid, you can learn speed at an early age. And so I'm selling a ton of super speed and I'm realizing, I could probably make a better product here. It's like simply a better mousetrap. Like let's have one stick instead of three. So there's the business opportunity and sort of working with, Tim Ramos, who is, he's the dad of one of the kids I coach, Andrew's his kid, and he's a great player himself. And we designed this product, kind of got it going. And it was initially like surprisingly successful. Like we launched it at Interlochen and we sold like 100 within a couple months. People loved the idea, the concept. And then it just kind of took off. Now we have a team of like 7 people and we've got engineers around the world and like we're doing products. And bottom line, like what I want to do with the vision of Ripstick is like create better training aids, but better training for people And with my background and my interest in motor learning, like that's really what it's all about. How can we get there faster?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I wanted to ask you this question earlier too. How much for golfers, whether they're like going into high school or college or trying to get to the next level, are you seeing more kids that solely focus on golf and then come to you and like they've just golfed their entire life? Or is it multi-sport athletes that seem to take on golf like a little bit easier and just become amazing at it because they have all these other skills from other sports? It's more like do you think it's better to be a like multi-sport athlete, or do you think, you know, kind of where it feels like our society is today, like if you're going to do something, focus on it from an early age and like hammering into it?
Well, I'm a believer for just a holistic perspective that you should play multiple sports. But if you specialize early and you make sure you have a lot of broad training within that, you can be pretty much focused on golf from age 5 or 6. But for a lot of kids, I don't think that's the right thing. Do you know what I mean? Like to make it on the PGA Tour, you're probably better off specializing from age 5, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But you better work on those other skills to make sure that you have it. Like, I'd love you to play ping pong at a high level and pickleball and badminton, all those sports that develop hand speed and coordination and face control. Those would be fantastic sort of ancillary drills, or motor components. Hockey would be great too. All those things are good, but I'd want you to continue golfing throughout the year, maybe with small breaks throughout the year. And that's where, like, again, we're not robots. So for the average bottom
Hideki, I feel like Hideki's kind of a robot.
There's some robots out there. And I do, like, I get these kids coming out of the woodwork from different parts of Minnesota and even globally where, like, I can tell they're wired differently. Like, they don't mind hitting balls for 3 hours a day. And these kids are going to be exceptional, but that's not the norm. And so I don't actually think it's that healthy to, like, do nothing but golf. I think you should do a lot of different things.
Yeah. I would agree too. It's just, I've noticed recently that it seems to be more of a trend that, you know, kids are getting more specialized into sports. And, you know, my mind and what I hear a lot of elite coaches talk about is like, they want to take on multi-sport athletes because you learn so much in other sports, but I just don't know if that's going to be the reality of like where things are going over the next couple of years. So it's interesting to talk about and have a conversation about. So on that point, you talked a little bit about like practicing and these kids that come in and they can just do stuff for 3 hours straight. I see you post a lot about block practicing and why you don't think block practicing is, you know, the way to go. I would have considered myself a block practicer for a really long time, until probably last year. And Andy and I were talking about this on the pod the other night, which is he really wants to start working more this year on skill development and less on technical development. Mm-hmm. And we kind of switched in that realm. I think when I first saw you, I kind of explained to you, like, I feel like I've gotten to a plus one making everything that I have the best it can be. And like, I can't do any more skill development. I need to make a change. And so now I'm in technical development, but I would like to get your thoughts on practice. You know, for the people that listen to us, they're typically club golfers, maybe good golfers. They do have the time to practice, but you know, their dads and have jobs or moms and have jobs, whatever. What's your just general take on one, how people should be practicing, and two, kind of the differences between skill and technical development, and what's the most important to kind of work on, obviously pending people's goals?
Yeah, this is right in my wheelhouse of like the interesting stuff. I think most people have no idea how to practice smart on both sides of the spectrum. And so what I mean by that is like, if you're doing technical work, and this is where we've jumped off with your own development, like you need to have the feedback you need to make sure that the swing is actually changing, right? And so that means actually taking away the golf ball a little bit or using a foam ball so you can verify that the video looks the way it needs to and you do the hard work and change that pattern.
You literally told me we were going to be doing martial arts, not swinging a golf club, I think was the term that you used.
Exactly. It's learning to move your body in completely different ways that exaggerate the pattern and make it change rapidly. And so I'll typically say like almost every golfer should basically learn how to do mechanical practice is a portion of their practice, maybe 20% or 30% of your practice. And that is completely video. It's all about ground force, plane, face angles, stuff that feels really hard to do and hit a good shot at the same time. And where most people are just incredibly inefficient about it is they're actually trying to hit good shots when they're doing mechanical work. And if you're trying to hit a good shot,
good luck.
Yeah. You got
too many things.
Yeah. You're thinking about too many things. So you can't do it. So that's where the foam ball came out. And like, that's getting a lot of interest. A lot of coaches are now adapting foam balls to practice mechanics, and you should like get that understanding. And for a lot of people that come to me for a first lesson, like they have no idea what a swing plane looks like. So I educate them. I give everybody a tripod. I show them, oh, this is what it should look like. This is how you get down to the ground. This is how you pivot, all that stuff. And then, you know, you don't have to hit any good shots. Just make that awesome. And I have so many lessons where come in and somebody will hit five shots. That's all I need to see. Then we're done. All we do is mechanics the rest of the day. You don't need to hit any balls today.
Yeah. So on that topic then, you said you kind of break down somebody's swing plan. This is pretty much what we did when I came in. So like, what are the stages of the swing or swing practice or whatever it might be that you actually break down and tell people? I know you mentioned like you can watch someone hit 3-4 balls and then it's mechanical work the rest. And then you kind of explain how they should be practicing.
Yeah.
People wanted to know how should they practice if, you know, they don't know any of that stuff and you just have an hour or two a day or in the summer and get to go to the range. Like what should people actually practice and in what order? Like how can you learn the quickest?
Yeah. So let's say you kind of are looking to not really change mechanics very much and you just want to optimize your skill, right? And so that would be somebody who's being like, I really don't want to do the foam ball work and make part of my practice that. Now, I'd always recommend like you should understand those skills. It feels like martial arts, but I understand some people don't want to practice that way. So then you're going to go to the range and you're going to say, what are my most important things to solve? And that would be the simple biases. Take care of those first. And the biases in golf are path. Maybe you're swinging too much inside out or outside in. You have your good shots look like big draws or fades. Probably should fix that. Get it closer to straight, right? Number two would be like just neutralize your face angle. So that means looking at your dispersion plot, instead of missing all right or all left, like make sure you miss half each way.
Okay.
You know, the whole idea of eliminating one side of the golf course doesn't exist.
We'll talk about 0.0 we'll path here in a little bit, but
you can't have a big bias. You can't have half your shots going in the rough and half in the fairway on the same side of the rough every time. And then the last one would be contact. Like get really good at solving contact. And that's as simple as if you're hitting the toe, hit the heel. But it also could be related to low point and some stuff like that. If your low point's poor, meaning you're hitting behind the ball too much or you don't trap it, then you got to work on that.
Okay. Makes sense. And like kind of in that realm, how do you identify somebody's, call it best matchup, right? So I started learning about matchups over the last year or two and kind of dawned on me when I see all these videos about like my TPI and they've got you hooked up to everything and you can see, you know, your swing and all that type of stuff. And I was like, man, it would be really sweet if like you could do that. And then they could show you the pro that your swing and matchup with, you know, the right techniques or whatever could be the closest to, because they've made it work and they're the best in the world.
Yeah.
How do you like, how much of what somebody has can be matchup? And then how much is, dude, you can't match that up with anything. Like you need to change this and like kind of talk me through that process. Cause that's where I've been at for a little bit and trying to understand, like I got really long arms, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have really good flexibility, but like, I don't have a lot of hip turn. Like I have bad hips. So there's only so much I can do. How do I find that matchup that's right for me to still, you know, play really good golf?
Right. So what I like to use is what we call like a constraint sled approach, meaning like, let's say you're naturally steep and you don't turn your hips. If we put a chili whacker or a pool noodle there just to make sure you're shallowing the club, and we make it simple, like if you hit it, you got to do a push-up every time, you're going to learn how to shallow that thing. You know what I mean? And then how you do that matters a little bit less to me generally. Makes sense? So you're going to find a way to do it. Now, there's sometimes where you don't have motor equivalence happening, meaning like you might try to shallow it just by never turning your hips in the downswing. That would be a bad matchup. And then your low point would be really poor. So sometimes it does matter. Other times it doesn't matter. But you always start with the simplest sort of way to get there for most people. And then you dig deeper if that is not working the way it needs to.
Okay. I had somebody ask about biomechanics and what are the most important biomechanics you see and or teach? Or like what are the ones that people can take in that make like the biggest improvements the quickest?
I'm really big on the pivot and the ground force stuff because that sets everything off in terms of sequencing. I used to try to, you know, a lot of people like have poor shaft lean and chunk shots. And so that's like basically an endemic for so many golfers. They're working on that stuff. And I used to try to feel like I would try to solve that just by getting the elbow in front and feeling like a late swish. And sometimes that works, but when I dug deeper into it, I realized that the root cause is often really poor ground force. They go up at the wrong time. They don't rotate their hips very
early
well.
Early extension then. Early extension,
yeah.
Me.
So, and as I started posting about this, something happened with online is like, I had a resounding sort of confirmation that people are interested in that. So now like literally 90% of my lessons are early extenders, you know, so the average golf pros, yeah, average golf pros probably fix slices. Like sounds cocky, but I just don't get people coming to me with slices. It's really easy to fix if it is coming, but it's mostly hard stuff of early extension. Because that's the stuff that is very difficult to fix.
Well, and I feel like, again, when I was learning the game, I felt like I was using the ground but to like get up on my toes, and that's how I'd create power. You're almost pushing off.
Yeah.
But using ground force, when you really understand it's completely different, right? You're almost feeling like you're nailing into the ground, not pushing off of the ground.
Yeah.
If I'm even making it. That's my feel.
You're a great example of a guy, like you had a matchup, but it was steep. So because you're steep and you're going to hammer the ground, you had to get out of the way, so you pushed up really hard with your toes. And because you're strong enough, you're a good athlete, you could do it, but that made your wedges really high.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I was hitting the ball super high. I couldn't flight anything to a number. It was unpredictable in terms of a couple yards. And then you start throwing wind out there, especially where I play out at Windsong.
Yeah.
No pun intended. It makes it really difficult.
And you took that to be a plus one, which is pretty awesome, but you could tell that's a little bit of a cap of how good you could be, especially in the wind, flighting a wedge. Like that's not an easy thing with your mechanics.
Yeah. 100%. So here we are today.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to tackle the topic because when I asked people about questions, it came up multiple times, which is this topic of, 0-0 path. So people were asking, one, what is 0-0 path? Two, why are so many people talking about it right now? Three, should I be scared of 0-0 path? And then I think the other one was like, just get his take on 0-0 path and like how different coaches or swing folks approach it. And like, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Obviously in golf, it's like anything, everything depends. You and I were kind of talking about how like, there's probably college coaches out there, and there are a lot that want the ball always working towards the hole, right? So if it's for right-handed player pinned in the left, gonna hit a draw. If it's on the right, going to hit a fade, and they always want the ball working towards that hole. What's your thought on 0-0 path and hitting just perfect straight balls?
Yeah, I have no problem. I teach a lot of players where we just try to get close to zero. Now, there's a lot of layers to this, and we can go as deep as you want, but bottom line...
So a lot of people asked about it.
Bottom line, it's just as easy to hit a dead straight shot as it is a one-yard draw or a 10-yard draw, okay? So if you're saying, all right, Luke, I'm going to hit a perfect 10-yard draw, I'll say good luck to you. It's not going to happen.
Is it because like the work or the practice you have to put in to get to 0.0 be the exact same to get to a, you know, 5+5?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's all like a subjective number, you know, like there's almost no difference. Like people think there's a big difference between, you know, +1 and -1. The difference between +1 and -1 is the same difference between +1 and +3. It's all arbitrary. It doesn't matter. And so what I would say is that hitting a straight shot is just as easy as hitting a perfect 10-yard draw or 10-yard fade. And so if your mind thinks that that's actually important to see a curve one way and you want to make that argument, you could do that. I would say we have a lot of like groupthink placebo on that idea because so many coaches, I'm probably less than 1% of, maybe 10% of coaches that actually think 0-0 is a good idea. But when you look at the statistics on tour, the guys that hit it the straightest in terms of hitting more fairways actually curve it less than the guys that are more crooked.
Okay. So if I just unpacked that for a second, then let's just all things equal. Let's just say that somebody could hit a 0-0 every time. And then somebody could hit a 5-yard draw, 5-yard fade. Wouldn't the counter argument be, well, if I can hit a perfect 5-yard draw and fade every time, I'm going to get a closer proximity to the hole? Or is it, well, no, that's inaccurate because of the 0-0, you could just aim right at the flagstick, hit 0-0.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing.
Yeah. Your dispersion pattern is going to be basically the same, whether you're +2 or 0, there's no reason your dispersion pattern is wider. Now, if you want to get in the physics of it, a 0-0 path gives you a better smash factor. There's actually less curve on the golf ball. And so it's a more direct hit. Obviously draws are always going to go farther, more smash factor because the club face is relatively closed, but there's no reason that you need to curve it one way or the other. It's all about making sure your miss pattern's tight and you're missing equally both ways, right? So if you're a drawer of the golf ball, you know, you like to see it start a little right, that's good. to eliminate, some people say, well, I need to know which way it's curving, but to actually eliminate a double cross is pretty ridiculously hard. You know, you think about how many guys on tour hit a draw and don't ever double cross and block it way right with the ball curving right. You'd have to be like 7 or 8 degrees inside out to do that. So then you're talking massive
it's
hooks.
Wild.
It's wild to actually eliminate a double cross. So then you say, well, how many standard deviations do I need to get away from a double cross? Because double crosses happen for all good players all the freaking time.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous to try that philosophy because you can't get there. You'd have to be 7 degrees one way or the other to eliminate a double cross. So logically, you just can't get there, in my opinion.
So then when people like, and I don't even want to call them arguments, discussions about this, what are they typically saying from the other side and why it is, you know, good to work the ball both ways? And like, why do so many people, you know, coach that when you start to get into skill development? Like, you need to be able to hit, you know, hook and draw, at least or hook and slice. You need to know how to do those things for recovery situations or whatever. Like, well, what's the thought process?
And I'm a huge advocate actually of being able to shape it when you need to. So you should be good at shaping the ball. And I teach all my juniors basically from age 10 to maybe 17, 18. Like, I want them to make sure that they can shape it both ways in practice. And then on the course, I like to see it when needed. I think when you look at, you know, who's going to be a better player long-term, it's probably the kid that's more creative and wants to try some of those wild shots. That's probably going to develop into a better player. Like, think if Tiger's coach, Rudy Durand, said, hey, Tiger, we're just going to hit one shot all the time. You're never going to shape it into different pins. Would Tiger be Tiger? I don't know, man. Like, I just don't know. I think he's probably better hitting shapes and being the player he was. And then you could say, well, Tiger's Tiger, so he could do this. Well, that's just flawed logic to say that you can't shape it and be a great player. Now, I will always say, like, go with the comfortable shot under the gun, but that comfortable shot can be 0-0. Doesn't matter.
You're hitting just straight shots all
day. With a putt, is 0-0 path okay?
I think it's perfect.
I think it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't actually, you know, it doesn't matter which side of the face we're on as long as the dispersion's tight.
Well, so on the topic of putting, I mean, I know you're a full swing coach. When it comes to other areas of the game, you know, chipping, putting, kind of walk me through just your thoughts in general on, like, you know, should somebody of, you know, my talent level, which call it scratch golfer, varies, but scratch golfer, you know, low handicap, should you be seeing different folks for your full swing, for your chipping, for your putting, or like, it, at what point does it all become, you know, too much, if you will? And like, and how much, you know, would you weight how important full swing is to chipping and putting techniques, and like, where do people start? Right? Cause I think that's one of the biggest things is I want to get a lesson, but man, I could really use a putting lesson. Like, I feel like I don't know. Man, I just need to hit more fairways. I should just go strictly for a driver lesson. Like, there's so many aspects to it. And I think that's where a lot of people get intimidated by even trying to go and get lessons. They don't know where to start. So I'm curious on your thoughts on that.
Well, I think it's good to find a specialist in that area. Like, I'm one of those coaches where, like, I just want my players to be better. It never bothers me if they go see another coach and I tell them straight up, like, hey, if you want to go get a putting lesson from somebody that knows more about, you know, the mechanics of putting, you can do that. Like, I've studied it. I know it decently well, but I don't do it every day. Most people come to me for full swing. What I really believe from a putting standpoint is, like, a lot of it's skill development. So this is where I actually don't like teaching technical stuff on putting very much. I'll have a lot of good college players come to me and say, what do you think of my stroke? And I think you need to learn how to putt. Like, you need to do the skill work. I don't think your stroke is bad at all. I think you should stop thinking about your stroke. And most of those kids start putting better as soon as I tell them their stroke's good.
Yeah. Like, you need to work on lag putting. You need to work on, like, not just hitting 100 3-footers in a row. You need to find different, right? Like, that. Yeah. This is the exact conversation Andy and I were talking about like, skill development versus technical development. And we feel that more people, would get more out of doing more skill development as opposed to technical development, because to your point, like, eventually a stroke is a stroke and a swing is a swing and it's going to peak. Right. Yeah. But what you can't do is, simulate, or it's not as easy to, you know, practice a 5-foot downhill slider with a putt, or like a chip that you got to get up into the air, whatever the case may be. It's, it's trying to break down the two between what's technical and what's skill.
And putting in particular, like, a lot of people think you need to hit it in the middle of face to be a good putter. There's a big correlation there, very little causation. Like, you could hit it quarter inch off the toe or a quarter inch heel and be a marvelous putter. It just so happens that good putters hit the middle of face because they have good coordination. You know what
I mean? Tiger's a little wear mark.
Right. They're going to hit the middle of face, but actually like practicing middle of face contact, if you have a mallet putter, it's not that important.
Yeah.
You need to learn how to read and speed the thing. Like that's way more important. So that's the skill work.
When I asked Larry Bobka about putting, and one of our guests had said, this is what he says every single time, is that putting is three things. It's speed, speed, and speed.
Yeah, right.
That's what he says. Yeah. And so like whenever anybody asks me about what I do for putting, I'm like, I just focus on speed now.
Yeah.
Because if you have the right speed, makes the hole bigger.
Yeah.
Right. And you got more chances of it going in.
Right. So. Yeah. And all the drills I do are predicated on variable practice, mixing up lines and speeds and making it really hard. And then also creating constraints within that practice session where you're incentivized to essentially have better speed all the time. Like, so if we're doing a drill, we're kind of doing a modified clock drill or going around the hole and doing it with different distances, which is how I do it. You got to have that thing roll 18 inches past the hole or you're penalized. If you're short or if you're too far, you lose points. So
incentivizing speed. Kind of like, and gamifying it, making practice fun, making it. Yeah, exactly. And so like now getting into some of the questions people asked, this is probably the most common that we just get in general. And like one of the topics people love to hear, and I want to hear what you think on it because it is hard, but at the end of the day, this is the question people want to know, which is I have 2 hours of practice every week and I play twice a week, right? Like when I practice, I'm either at the golf course and it's the range before my round or it's a little bit after. And it's somebody who's probably, mid handicapper, maybe a little higher, somewhere in that 0 to 10 range, somewhere in there. What is your take on how people can get the most out of those practice sessions? Is it a mixture between skill and technical? Is it just skill development because that person clearly doesn't have the time to dedicate to the technical development even needed to make enough change for it to matter? Or what's your take?
It's really a tough answer because it depends on the person. Because some people with 2 hours a week can make some nice technical improvements and get a lot better, right? Some people have mismatched things that are just like fundamentally flawed. They have a bias right or left. They need to fix that, right? So if you have biases in your game, then go get a technical lesson and fix those biases. And you're probably better off doing some block practice to do that. Now, let's say you don't have a big bias, like you don't miss right a lot or left a lot. You just kind of have a kind of a dispersion pattern that's wider than you want. Then you're probably better off doing skill work if you don't have a lot of time. And at that point, it means switching targets, switching clubs, gamifying, working on different lies, making sure you kind of check all the boxes on things that avoid double bogeys, like being a good bunker player, making sure that you can pitch it well from different lies, stuff like that.
Yeah. I think that's going to start being my answer too over the last couple of weeks as I've realized this, which is like, you need to stop going to the range and trying to perfect a 7-iron.
Yeah.
Like you need to go and you need to be very, you know, that skill development aspect of, all right, I'm going to start with a 7-iron, but I'm going to hit a 160-yard cut. And then I'm going to take out a wedge. I'm going to hit a 100-yard flighted low shot, right? Just practice different things instead of the term that you block practicing.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to start getting away from block practicing unless it's technical development stuff that I don't really care where the ball goes.
Yeah. I mean, you'll see in the research, like people tend to follow like short-term practice effects. They want to feel good about themselves. And so they'll like hit a bunch of 7-irons in a row. And it, unfortunately, it just doesn't cross over or transfer very well. So the way we measure learning is through a transfer test or a retention test. Transfer we do later and we transfer it to a different kind of environment, right? So we take it on the course and we see if it works. Or you go do a retention test and you see if somebody's learned. And we know over and over block practice does not actually show very much in terms of that compared to variable. So it's switching it up is really good. Even though you feel bad about yourself, you don't think you're doing as well, it actually helps you perform on the course.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, that's the hardest part too, just for being in Minnesota, right? Like we practice in simulators. We can't go out and putt on real grass very often, or we can't go do bunker practice. So you're in a simulator, a controlled environment, no wind, perfect lie every single time. And then people wonder why, they get to the summer and they don't see the same results. Like, well, all of a sudden you're on an uphill or downhill lie and Yeah. That completely changes like what you do. Although I have seen some of your videos where you've got people on, to practice that stuff.
Once their swings are pretty good and they don't have a bias in their game, like that's when we get crazy. We change clubs a lot. We change shapes a lot. We make uneven lies. We add pressure. I love to do stuff like, high score has to sing Jingle Bells. Like I want them to stress out and find as many ways as we can to make practice hard. So it transfers better.
Yeah. Gamifying it, making it hard. So a question from Dustin NG, should you work on speed while working on technique?
Absolutely. You should learn how to swing really fast, making a perfect golf swing. And so the way you do that is you utilize freezers. And so freezer is like a good chance, and you've done plenty of these now.
Yeah.
Freezer is a good chance to kind of cross into what we call open loop and closed loop sort of patterns. So open loops and closed loop means like, do you have time to change your pattern during the swing? Are you adjusting to the environment? Because in golf, it happens so fast. And if all you do is hit balls, trying to think about it going full speed, you can't change that pattern. It's really hard to change. And that's why so many people are unsuccessful for years and years. They fight early extension because like, oh, I'll keep my butt back. Well, it doesn't really change. Well, you can use speed training, but do it from a freezer standpoint first. So take it to the top, like freeze, and then start with really aggressive lower body. Get the chest over, shallow it. Make the swing look awesome while you're also swinging fast. Because when you go test it on the course, body's going to want to go fast anyway.
We had one of Andy's best friends, and he was a professional baseball player. His name was Danny Holtzen. I think his episode's a few episodes ago, but I heard him talking about when he was coming back from like rehab, he'd had surgery. He would do not freezers, but he would literally do his windup. But it would take him 3 minutes to do it.
Wow.
So he would move like as slow as possible to like retrain his brain on like where things should be moving in the path.
Wow.
And I thought that is like a really interesting concept as well in the same realm as freezers, right? Where you're trying to get those specific feels and specific areas to retrain, like motor training.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I generally poo-poo slow motion compared to freezers. The reason I do that is because you have motion dependent torques, which means like when you go fast, everything unravels and goes differently. But just for feeling the move, if you have no idea what impact feels like, that's going to be really helpful for slow motion. And so for a guy like Danny, maybe that's what he's trying to do is feel some new positions and then go ahead and do it full speed with a freezer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Somebody asked specifically about the rip. They want to know how you came up with the design of the Ripstick. And then they also want to know if you have any new products coming out.
Now,
this wasn't you that asked this, by the way. Nice. It's actually Jamie Rue.
There you go.
I don't know if you know Jamie or not.
No.
One of our buddies.
Cool. RIP stands for reach your potential. So we're really about like maximizing practice and making practice efficient is what we're all about, helping you reach that next goal. And the logo, if you look at it, kind of looks like a trajectory of a long shot if you look at the Ripstick logo. That's what it stands for. Yeah.
All right there.
This one's simple. Yeah.
Nice.
So new products. We got kind of like a balance board coming out. That's really simple, but it works really well for just teaching, especially somebody that doesn't have a good weight shift, linear trace. If they don't get to the front foot, it's really good. We got a radar coming out. That's awesome. That'll Bluetooth.
Radar?
Yeah.
Like a,
it's like the PRGR, but it's better. So it's simple. It's going to give you a really accurate sort of like club speed and ball speed. So you can hit with it and do some random number practice and it'll Bluetooth right to it. So then all your data goes in together.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. We're excited about that because I think there is always a market for a low budget radar that's really accurate. And that's what this is.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, and I assume you'd use it indoor, outdoor.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. People want to know their numbers. They want to know what they're swinging like. And again, talking about controlled environments and simulators, like, you can hit 100 balls, but they're not always going to be accurate, right? Like you get these weird ball flights. I know like when I hit on TrackMan's indoors, right? Like they're more made for watching the flight outdoors. Every now and again, I'll hit one off the heel, but it'll just be a like duck hook draw 100 yards, right? Yeah. So like you don't actually know all the time how accurate something is until you get outside or until you actually hit in the environment you're playing.
Very true with radar, yeah.
Last question. What is the biggest golf myth out there? Like bobblehead golf.
Yeah, bobblehead.
I don't know who that is.
Will Frazier over at St. Thomas.
Okay. Good player. He wants to know what the biggest golf myth out there is.
I think I think for top players, it really is that idea of you should A, not shape it very much. I think you should develop those skills when you're young and then use it when you need it, you know? And then B would be like, be afraid of 0-0. Like 0-0 is not death. Like if you go watch a lot of good players, especially with a wedge in their hands, they're like pretty close to zero. And there's a lot of good drivers that are close to 0-0 too on the PGA Tour. So I think that's some of the myths for kind of low handicap players. And then, you know, for beginners, a lot of it is like, they just don't understand that ripping seven irons at the range is going to make them better. Yeah. It's just,
that was me for a long time.
They think that's what it takes. And they don't understand skill practice at all and how to make it much harder to actually get better results.
Yeah. That was me for a very, very long time. And then when I got out to Winsong a few years ago, and started watching how just other like better players practice and stuff. I mean, I think when you get in those club environments, I imagine Interlaken this way too, like you just see a lot more better golfers, right? Yeah. Than like if you just go to a normal public range, like you're going to see a lot of people just trying to practice the golf swing and, you know, they're out there doing what you said, just hitting balls on the range. And then, you know, start to go to a club or like a private facility or whatever it might be. And like, I see guys spend more time just chipping and putting than I do ever hitting golf balls, you know? And so it's really interesting when you start to change the way you think about practice and approaching the game. There's just a lot of stuff, like you said, that beginners probably don't understand, and that takes a little while to understand. So maybe they'll listen to this and get a little bit of value out of it, which would be great.
Yeah.
I want to talk about too, lastly, Interlaken. You're out of Interlaken. Everybody wants to know when it's going to be open, how things are looking out there. I went and saw your new shed. I call it a shed, or is it a...
Yeah, I mean, we're...
You got your own little area out there, man. It's pretty sweet.
No, they built us a three-bay TrackMan setup, which is awesome. And we got so busy there that they had to build me my own little facility for teaching. So we have two Foresight facility, and then we have a three TrackMan facility. So it's awesome.
Wow.
And then obviously the golf course project is awesome too. So I'm pretty excited for that. We'll open in July at some point. And
July of this year.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously first year it'll be a little tender. We probably won't do a ton of rounds. I think they're going to probably have stagger out those tee times a little bit. And it'll be a lot of caddies. We're not going to have carts out there very much, I would imagine. But it's going to be super cool. And I think within a year or two, we're going to see all that kind of come to fruition in terms of the grass will be awesome. You know, first year in, you're going to have holes, right? But it's going to be pretty good. And then in 2-3 years, it's going to be really awesome.
Yeah. How, I mean, not to get too like technical on golf course type stuff, but, any changes to the golf course that you're like actually looking forward to? I mean, I probably know off the top of my head, you know, probably 13, 14 holes, you know, I can get pretty close on the front nine and the back. I mean, I obviously know 18. I know, I'm going through like 10 and 11. I'm going across the bridge in my head. Are there any like major changes that maybe people who have played it before are like going to come back out and be like, whoa.
Well, I think the most exciting thing is the amount of nuance that they're going to add to it in terms of the green complexes. The greens are getting a little bit bigger. They're going to have a lot more pin placements because with our old greens, you know, piling up decades and decades of sand on top, they just get so rounded and mounded.
Yeah.
And actually, when you go back to Donald Ross original, like a lot of it is square shaped greens with more pin placements and way more complexity and ridges. So now actually the greens will have a little less slope, but then you can maintain speed a little bit better on them. The bunkering I think will be a little bit more interesting as well. And then it is, I mean, we took down a lot of trees, so it's going to look, they built pretty.
Open.
Yeah.
It seems like modern golf.
It's the modern golf.
Yeah. It feels like, I mean, we play out at Winsong, and that's, you know, even they took down some trees. They don't even have that many trees to begin with, you know? So it's, I just feel like that's, people want to hit the ball far out. They want it to be fun. They want to be able to find their ball and keep pace of play up too. Right. That's probably a big component of it.
Yep. And then they add a bunch of like, hummocks or moguls, which will kind of make bombers think a little bit more, I think, versus, you know, you can incentivize people to hit in the fairway with trees, bunkers, or mounds. And we chose some mounds, which is Donald Ross original stuff. So it'll be exciting. And number 10 is probably the biggest, move the green back about 40 yards. So that's a big difference. It's going to be a longer hole. And
really
then
a long par four then.
Yeah. It's going to be a long par four. And, other than that, it's mostly greens, you know, 17 will be a par three. That's 270 or 275. So that'll be a nice long hole. Yeah. So,
270 yard par three.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully it's playing downwind most days.
Mostly cross, but, it'll be great.
Yeah. last thing they have, I hope they have pickleball courts out there for you.
Yeah.
You're going to have pickleball.
Yeah.
So you told me that you're a pretty good pickleball player. So what's
getting there? I'm
what's the rating at right now?
I'm a 5-0, although I don't know if I'm playing to it right now, but
okay. For people that don't know, that's probably would you say that's a zero? No, it's probably plus.
I don't
plus
know.
If it's two, plus. Maybe.
I started playing.
It's probably
in
a
June.
Scratch. I mean, that's you're an elite. You're a 5-0, like you play pickleball.
I love it. It's super fun because it's, as you know, just a lot of strategy and you just develop some motor skills. And then there's just, it's a fun sort of like, you know, getting involved in golf and all the different layers to it. Pickleball's got a lot of layers. It's like mastering different parts of the game. It's like your short game's like you're dinking and you got your power with your drives and you got to start. It's all fun. I love that.
It's an awesome sport. I hope maybe one of these days after a lesson, we can just,
we'll go play.
We can play some ones. Yeah. You can probably get me running around.
But. Yeah. I got a long way to go. I've played against some really good players and it's like, you know, this whole thing is relative, just like in golf, you know, like some people think I'm good at golf as a zero or you're good as a zero, man. There's so many layers to that too, aren't there?
Yeah, man, dude, I played in like a open thing out at Edina Lifetime. And there were these guys that are, I guess they're considered pros. I think they're like, you know, they're well over 5-0. I don't even know what dupers go to past that, but they clearly had tennis backgrounds and they needed a fourth. And I was like, yeah, I'll play, you know, I'm like right at a 4-0, a little bit higher than that. I'm like, okay, yeah, come on in.
Yeah.
And man, I get into this game. And first of all, they had the new ball, whatever like
a little faster
one, that thing is faster and flies and bounces way different. Like one, it took me a whole game to get used to the pro ball.
Yeah.
If you will. And then two, the thing I noticed is that there's so much more dinking when you get to the higher levels because they're trying to get you out of position, and then their hand speed at the net is absolutely incredible. It feels like you can't hit it anywhere at or around them because they're going to get to it. Uh-huh. You're literally just got to get them out of position so that you can hit the ball as far away from as possible.
Yeah.
It is a completely different game and it opens your eyes to it. It's wild.
Yeah. It's super humbling. Like I'm getting better, but man, I'll never be like those guys. And so that's what I feel as I'm getting into pickleball. It helps me associate with like golfers trying to get better. It's really, really hard to be awesome.
Yeah.
You just enjoy the journey getting better along the way.
It's fun. Thing. Practice is fun. Playing is fun. And at the end of the day, if you're outside or wherever playing a sport, you're probably having a pretty good day.
Exactly.
So, yeah. I appreciate you coming on. I'm sure we'll have you on again. Any last comments or
no, I like
our Minnesota
depth
audience.
And find me on Instagram if you want to bug me about zero.
I'll make sure we tag you too. It's dr.luke.benoit, B-E-N-O-I-T.
Yeah, for sure.
And then Ripstick, R-Y-P-S-T-I-C-K.
Yeah. And if I could say, you know, we've got this new facility, Rip Academy. It's in South Edina, 494 Bush Lake. Great. Yeah. I mean, we've got 11 simulators. Come by. We have tons of high school kids running around. But we're looking for anybody that wants to hit balls, and we're the cheapest place in town. And all our staff is PGA pros, so we're there to help you guys. You know, like if you want to come in and hit balls, like you're gonna get a tip or two for free. It's part of the deal.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's an awesome spot too. I think the only reason I haven't showed up like during some of the like, I'm gonna get my ass kicked by these high schoolers. It's just gonna drive me insane. But it also would probably present a pretty good learning opportunity. But man, I watched some of the videos of the kids that you coach. And it's just like, dude, I wish I could move like that.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah. You develop the speed in that window of, you know, 13 to 18 and it's pretty amazing. And
awesome, man. Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Send everybody to follow you on Instagram and appreciate it, man. Cool. Looking forward to more lessons with you.
Thanks, Jordan. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Luke.